Well, let's read Ezra chapter 4, titled The Opposition. Now, if you were here last week, I said that it's not at all uncommon to carry chapter 3 on, if you look at the way that the book is divided in quite a few commentaries. The commentators carry on chapter 3 into chapter 4, verse 5, and we'll see why they might do that in a few moments. But we're following the chapterings because whilst there is a narrative flow from the beginning of 3 to chapter 4, verse 5, chapter 4 is a unit, and it is a thematic unit, and its theme, the thing that brings the whole chapter together, despite its various chronological sort of stages, is opposition to God's work. And so it's opposition to the work of rebuilding the temple, which is where chapter 3 ended, but it's also opposition to later work that was going on, the rebuilding of the walls. So that's why we're taking chapter 4 as a whole. It's because it does have a coherence to it around the theme of opposition. So let's read chapter 4. As we're coming into that, we know that chapter 3 has ended with a sound going out from Jerusalem. The people have gathered, they're worshipping God in the temple, they've re-established the offerings, they've laid the foundations for the new temple to be rebuilt, and those who remember the old one are looking at it and thinking, this is awful, just look at it. Those who don't remember that are just full of joy, thinking, look at it, you know. So always in any congregation, you're going to find people saying, oh, look at it. And there are going to be people thinking, look at it. You know, it's just that's the dynamic of things. And they've all had this sort of great shout of either joy or sound of weeping at the end of verse 13. Now, it's not sort of an accident that we have shouts of joy, verse 13 of chapter 3. Sound of weeping, the people made so much noise, and the sound was heard far away. And then when the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord. Now, what 4 opens with is not the sound of that shout going out, but it's the sound of everything that that shout means that has gone out. So they've had this great noise on that occasion, but it has just kept echoing out. You know, why have they made that noise? What are they doing that they should all be there? Why is that such an important place for them? What is going on? And they hear what the people around about hear what's happening. So that's where we sort of break in now. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families, and said, let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God, and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. Esarhaddon, also Ashurbanipal, is called. But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, you have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for Yahweh, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of his associates wrote a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic script and in the Aramaic language. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes the king as follows. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, together with the rest of their associates, the judges and officials over the men from Tripolis, Persia, Erech, and Babylon, the Elamites of Susa, and the other people whom the great and honorable Ashurbanipal deported and settled in the city of Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. This is a copy of the letter they sent him to King Artaxerxes from your servants, the men of Trans-Euphrates. The king should know that the Jews who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid, and the royal revenues will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace, and it is not proper for us to see the king dishonored, we are sending this message to inform the king, so that a search may be made of the archives of your predecessors. In these records you will find that this city is a rebellious city, troublesome to kings and provinces, a place of rebellion from ancient times. That is why this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are restored, you will be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. The king sent this reply to Rehum, the commanding officer, Shimshai, the secretary, and the rest of their associates living in Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. Greetings. The letter you sent us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order, and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolt against kings, and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates, and taxes, tribute, and duty were paid to them. Now issue an order to these men to stop work, so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this manner. Why let this threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests? As soon as a copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary, and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. Thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now, little recap, because it's important for us to make the connection that Ezra makes. The people have returned, 50,000 of them, returned from exile. Cyrus has said, you must go back and rebuild the temple. And he said that to a lot of people who had been carted into a kind of a centralized system that the Babylonians had. He has beat the Babylonians and become, in doing so, the emperor of a vast empire. And he has wanted to strengthen the peripheries of his empire rather than weaken them and pull everything into the center. So he's kind of flung people out in that kind of centrifugal way. And so he's sent the Jews back. He's made sure that they're resourced from the places where they were going from back to Jerusalem, and they've gone back expressly to rebuild the temple. So they have gone back, and they've, you know, settled, but it got on with the work of rebuilding the temple. And the first thing they did, as we were thinking of last week, is they've rebuilt the altar, because that's the place of sacrifice, and that's the place where sin is dealt with, and that's the place where God had said back in Exodus, there I will meet with you. So the altar is, if you like, the ground zero of fellowship with God. It's the ground zero of fellowship with God because it's the place where every obstacle that comes between his people and him, that is their sin, is dealt with. It is dealt with in that it is acknowledged. You don't make a sacrifice if you don't think you've sinned. It's acknowledged, and it is atoned for. A covering is made by the sacrifice. And a whole system of sacrifices and feasts and offerings centered on the altar. Not just the temple per se, but the altar within it. So it is, if you like, the ground zero of fellowship with God. And God would burn up what was there. The people would burn it, but God would also burn up what was on altars. And he would come into the place where the altar was, and make his presence the defining thing, therefore, for all the people. Who are we? We are Yahweh's people. How do you know what Yahweh is like? How do you meet with him? How is he amongst you? He's amongst us at the place where sin is dealt with, where fellowship with God is restored, where we are with our Maker again. And so they go to the place of fellowship with God. They rebuild it and offer the sacrifices, the place that defines them more than anything else as the people. And it is that that sends these sort of shockwaves out to the peoples round about. They realize that there are people back there who are not being cowed under the impressive, massive, spectacular gods of the big empires. They are not being intimidated, even though they are small in number and living amongst ruins and living in a land that has not been looked after and farmed for yonks, 70 years, more. And immediately there is recognized that this is a threat. This is a threat to everybody round about. This is a threat to their power, because they can't intimidate these people. They've been broken. They're returning. And more than anything else, they're conscious that God is in their midst. So there's something in the smallness and the centrality of worship and the altar that is disturbing for everybody round about. And it immediately evokes the opposition. Now, in chapter 4, what Ezra, who, if we're reckoning it was Ezra that was putting together stuff from all the records to describe this first wave of exile led by Zerubbabel. And we know that it wasn't Ezra who was there at the time, and he's putting together records, because Ezra led the second wave 90 years later. So, you know, he would have been an incredibly old man to have done that. So he's putting together patches of records and stories and fragments of this, that, and the other, and he's piecing together what happened. And so important is the opposition that he devotes a whole section to it. And he's pulling bits from different historical periods into this to make not a point about the chronology of where everything happened, but to make a point about the nature of what was happening. That is, that it was so pleasing to God that it was opposed by everybody. It was so honoring to God that it was anathema, awful to others. It was so empowering of his people that they became a threat to everybody. Not a military threat, of course, but here were a people whom they could not control, because here was a people that somebody else was controlling. So as Ezra is compiling everything, you can sort of picture the wheels going round, thinking, you know, there's something so important here that we need just to pull everything together on this, never mind the historical chronology. Now, that is just a little side issue. That is a distinctively Hebrew way of looking at things anyway, and of writing things. The Hebrew mindset, all the way up to the exile, and still pretty predominantly after the exile, was not really interested in chronos, the chronology of things. And that Greek word chronos, which describes the flow of time, you know, and ticking it off, marking it off. You know, you've got this flow of time, and it's passing our clocks and making them tick and all that kind of thing. Not really interested in that. Couldn't give a scoopy about that. Because they were essentially agricultural people. And the thing that they responded to was not, what time is it? But is it the right time to do something? And the right time was defined not by the calendar, and there were calendars around, and not by sundials or anything. The right time was described by the conditions. Is this the right time to plant? Look at the weather. Look at the soil. Yes. Is this the right time to harvest? Look at the grain. Look at the sun. Oh, is it going to be rain? Let's do it now. It is what in the New Testament is called kairos. Is this the right moment? Now, there is one supreme expression of that Hebrew mentality, which is very wise, because it makes sure that you do the right thing at the right time, not doing the right thing because it happens to be 4 o'clock and everything stops for tea at 4 o'clock, or even doing the wrong thing at a particular time. That sensitivity to the moment. And primarily, when Israel was at its best, that sensitivity to the moment as God is defining it. What conditions is God creating? What circumstance? What is he bringing together here? He's bringing the sun. He's bringing the soil. He's bringing the rain. He's bringing the people. Now is the time God wants us to harvest. And when we've done that, we will have a feast, a festival in God's presence and make the offerings. You see, they're not saying it's the 13th day past next September or something like that, and it's 3:30 in the morning, therefore we must do it. This is the time, because of what God is doing, God who is constantly active, constantly making things happen. Now, there is one supreme little summary of that whole mentality in the Old Testament, and it's that lovely bit in Ecclesiastes 3, that sort of poem, that ode to time. A time to, time to build, a time to tear down. A time to weep, a time to rejoice. Time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. Time to live, time to die. The whole thing is about time, just interpreting the times. Now, what's going on in Ezra's mind is that's the way he thinks. So he mixes up the chronology because he's wanting to make a point about what happens to God's people when they are faithful to God in this world that we are called to win. So, if you're paying attention as we were reading, you might have thought, hang on a minute, we get verses 1 to 5, we know that we're in the reign of King Cyrus, right down to 4, and then into 5, we get frustrated their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia. Yeah, we know that. And down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And then we've got another one coming in. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, verse 6. And then another one, 7, in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. So we've got there Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes and Artaxerxes, 4 kings of Persia. Right? And the bulk of the chapter, 7 right down to 23, is actually all about what happened in terms of opposition during the reign of Artaxerxes. By which stage the temple had already been built, and the walls are now being rebuilt, little bit by little bit. And it's towards the end of, it's after the stopping of the rebuilding of the walls. It's after that that Nehemiah gets the call to go back. And the whole stopping of it that Artaxerxes had been tricked into doing gets reversed and it gets started and the whole thing's built in 53 days or something, 52 days, something like that. So the chapter spans a lot of time. The bulk of it, 7 through 23, is later than the rebuilding of the temple. It's down to the building of the walls, but it's still on the topic of opposition. And then Ezra just sort of slips right back at the end of the chapter and says, thus the work on the house of God, back temple again, in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So 24 is a summary of 1 to 5. You get that? So you could just, if you're wondering about the chronology, you just take out 6 Xerxes and then 7 to 23 Artaxerxes. And then, just move 24 right up to the end of verse 5. And that's how that little chunk works. So, you see how, now, as you may have guessed, there is, you know, you get the sense of a chart coming here, don't you? You get the feeling that there's going to be a timeline. So, third chart in the Ezra series. Thank you, Sam. Andrew, I can give you that one. Thank you. Distribute at will. Now, in order to get the span of it all, here's a crafty little piece of paper, which when you get, you will immediately recognize as something worth treasuring. There's a subtle use of color. The Persian kings are all in blue and bold. Of course, mostly they were bold. Now, Cyrus, as he's called in our chapter, is actually Cyrus II, because there was another Cyrus before that. And you'll see just a little bit above there, the first three lines. It's just the kind of feed into the whole rule of the Persians thing. So 607, captivity begins, you get a first lot of people deported. Jehoiakim is the king, you read about that in the references there. 597, you get a massive deportation from Jerusalem when Jehoiakim is a puppet king. 586, that's when the big destruction falls. Say the walls destroyed, gates destroyed, temple destroyed, the whole city just left, you know, in rubble. And by and large, uninhabited. There's some people did stay. And then that all happened. You get the reign of the Babylonians. And then 559, Cyrus II becomes king of Persia. And he grows in his strength and his power and his influence. And in 538, he becomes top dog of the ancient Near East as Cyrus defeats the Babylonians. And that is his first year. That's described as the first year of Cyrus. So, because that's the first year of the great Persian Empire. So, chapter 1, verse 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that's 538. It's not the first year he was king of Persia, it's the first year he became the emperor of, you know, the known world, kind of thing. And the same year, first exiles return, chapter 1 and chapter 2. Little aside, as we go down, we get Daniel prospering under King Cyrus, later on in Daniel's life there, because of course Daniel and his friends were counted off by the Babylonians. And then 535, what we were looking at in chapter 3, the altar and the foundation of the temple are begun. Zerubbabel is leading at this stage. Shealtiel is mentioned in chapter 1, Zerubbabel 2 and 3. And then here's our chapter. Opposition to the temple construction begins that same year, 535. And that's the first five verses of our chapter. Now, chapter 5 says, the high councils are working against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia. So it began early, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So that includes Sambyses in there, although he doesn't get a particular mention because he was, you know, obviously not that much of a star. And the opposition goes right the way down, and eventually, under King Darius, gets resumed in 520. So that is verse 24 of our chapter. Thus the work of the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So he became king in 522. 520, the rebuilding resumes. Okay, came to a standstill until 520, his second year. So 524... Sorry, chapter 4, verse 24, right the way through to 6:12, is the story of the rebuilding resuming under Darius the First. And in 5:16, it's finished. And we have the whole dedication thing in the second part of chapter 6. Now, things go quiet then, as far as the book of Ezra is concerned. Xerxes becomes king. You find him elsewhere called Ahasuerus. That's his Hebrew name. That's what the name the Hebrews gave him. Then we have 486, the rebuilding of the walls is stopped by opposition. Now we're onto walls. And that's what we get sewn into the opposition chapter. So we get that sort of sewing in there of, in 7 through to 23, of what happened in the reign of, 6 to 23, shouldn't it, not 7 to 23, of Xerxes and then Artaxerxes. Esther becomes queen of Persia during that period. And then Xerxes is replaced by Artaxerxes, and then we get 7 to 23. So verse 6 is rebuilding the wall stopped by opposition to King Xerxes. That's the wrong reference in there. It should just say Ezra 4:6, so you can make that change. And then you go down into Artaxerxes 7 to 23, as we've got it, and the stopping of the rebuilding of the walls. Ezra leads the second exile group back under Artaxerxes 7, and that story occupies the second part of the book of Ezra, chapter 7 to 10. And then we get a third exile group returning, led by Nehemiah. The walls get rebuilt in double quick time. Somewhere around then we have Ezra actually putting the book together, if it was Ezra or whoever we have the book written. Nehemiah went back to serve Artaxerxes, and then he was away for about 12 years or so. went, did the work, and then was away for 12 years, came back as the prime minister, if you like, or something if you want to phrase it, of Jerusalem and environs, and a whole lot of reforms that have to be instituted. And you'll see in green the prophets who were prophesying, the post-exilic prophets, and purple where books have written, as far as we're able to say. So the whole Old Testament period ends at the book of Malachi, historically. And we have from about 400 on the intertestamental period, beginning 333 or 334, depending on what you do, your dating. The Greek Empire begins. So you can see what's happening here. What Ezra's done is he's taken material that belongs to a later period and sewn it into four. So that's how it works, and that's why it seems very strange. You suddenly get verse 24 coming in, which seems to belong to the end of 5, which chronologically it does. But he's wanting to make a different point from just laying out chronology. He's wanting to tell us about opposition. So now, part 2 on the handout, what is the nature of the opposition? And there's a typo, the S at the bottom should be a letter I. And that might help you guess. So here you get to fill in the words. What's the nature of the opposition? And we are looking at this not simply because this is Ezra's account of opposition that was faced by people rebuilding Jerusalem over many, many years, but because this is God's book for God's people now. And this is a training manual for how to spot what the enemy is doing. Right? This is a training manual for the church now in how to spot what the enemy is doing, how to get to know how the enemy of God's work will work. So what we're doing is we're learning here things which we do find elsewhere in the scriptures all over the place. We're learning things which are going to apply to you and me and to any fellowship we belong to, certainly to guilt. What's the nature of the opposition? First of all, it's a, and you might want to guess, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, what that C might stand for. The opposition comes, it's a conspiracy. Well done. Excellent. It's a conspiracy. It is very, very rare that God's work is ever remotely effectively opposed by an individual or by some one person in the world who doesn't like a bunch of Christians. There is a conspiracy here. There is an amassing of forces. Remember how Jesus is described as having been surrounded by dogs. When we think of the time being right for God to have sent his son, and we recognize that means it was the time was right for opposing him. Not necessarily for getting the gospel going out, but for opposing him. It was just a gathering conspiracy of a range of Jewish leaders and represented in the Sanhedrin. But there were other parties as well. The relationship between the Pharisees as a whole and the Sanhedrin, it was not always a comfortable relationship, but they sure got together when it came to getting rid of Jesus. And right at the end, there is this strange sort of coalition of Roman forces and Jewish forces against Jesus. You see, it's this conspiracy thing. Coalition would have been just as good in a sense. That Satan commands groups and collective things. These principalities and powers, plural, that we're up against. So the opposition to what God is doing will come on many fronts at the same time. If we were to take time to sort of wind the Old Testament clock back and go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 20, when Jehoshaphat is king in Jerusalem, we've got this coalition of surrounding forces, many of them part of this, the Trans-Euphrates group, as they later became called. So you've got men of Edom, Moab, Mount Seir. When you plot the places where they come, that's like three sides around Judah. You know, we don't actually have anybody landing from the air. And we don't have a seaborne force coming in and pounding them from the coast. But one sort of north, east and south, they're getting squeezed. Now, it's that coalition so that the church, a congregation, and as individual Christians we face it as well, we end up with battles, if you like, on many fronts at the same time. Second, it is, you might want to guess what that P stands for, or maybe not, persistent. Remember, Jesus tempted in the wilderness, and the devil left him. We read at the end of the story of temptation. But we know that it wasn't for long, because he came back again. And when the Pharisees and the teachers of the law didn't get Jesus, on one point they would come back again, and again, and again. It's persistent, and it is, in fact, normal. It's not comfortable. It doesn't belong to, you know, this kind of idea that we have that if you reach a certain level of maturity, and Christian maturity and godliness, and you're getting enough things right in your life, you will have a calm, even life. Now, I don't know where that came from, but it didn't come from the Bible. Don't know where it came from, but it did not come from the Bible. Because the Bible talks about persistent, dogged, determined, resolved opposition to the work of God. So we must, through many hardships, said Paul and Barnabas, enter the kingdom of God. The picture we've got of the life of the church in Revelation 12 is of Satan trying to devour the church at Christ's birth, kill him, you know, the slaughter of the innocents. And then he goes after the church. And the whole of what we would recognize as history in the time we live in, from Christ's ascension to now, is encompassed in Revelation 12 as Satan going after the church. All of it. Paul writing the church in Rome, not a new believer by any means, says, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of flesh? Any good that I would, I do not. Those things that I would not do, those very things I do. I find this law at work within me." He doesn't get free from it. In this body of flesh, it is persistent. So when you think things are fine and great and easy, and you've just come through a great, you know, sort of experience, you might go off watch, so to speak. But does the devil say, "Oh well, I better give them a rest for a while, aren't I? You know, I know they've gone off watch, so they deserve a break. Give them a, you know, I'll just pull back for a while." Not at all. So it's this persistent thing. He's just always going to oppose God. It focuses on God and on power. What has evoked this, and what they want to stop during the reign of Cyrus down to the second year of Darius, verse 24, what they want to stop is rebuilding of the temple. Now, they want to stop rebuilding the temple because that's what's getting rebuilt. They're not really working on the walls very much. So, you know, they're going to oppose whatever building is going on. They're building a temple, therefore the temple is getting opposed. But the way that it's set up in Ezra, from 3 into 4, doesn't let you think that's just a historical accident. It's making the point, look, they've done what we call in Ezra 2, they've done the God first in your life thing. And that's what's got to stop. If they get a temple, and if they are living in fear and worship and love of their God, who knows what they might not do? Your walls are actually more difficult to rebuild, and they're easier to oppose because they're right on the edges and you get to them first. But there's something about stopping them. Don't let them live with their God that is going on. So it focuses on God in their midst. And it focuses on power. You see, the people of the Trans-Euphrates, these leaders, during the building of the temple in Cyrus and down to the second year of Darius, those people are suddenly, as we're saying, losing power. Under the Babylonians, and now for a period under Cyrus, they have been able to exercise, particularly under Cyrus, a remarkable degree of local power. Now, here's a group of people who have been sent back directly by Cyrus. So they've got a bit of a royal badge on them. You know, they're kind of in here. They've got the Cyrus cylinder. This before it was equipped for the British Museum. They've got it, and it says it. So, you know, yaboo, here we are. We've got the king on our side. And you can just sense how their feeling of power is just ebbing away. So what they have to do is reestablish power. So they have a strategy. And here are four parts of the strategy, which are involved in, you know, right the way through here. They're the sort of composite thing. The first is this infiltration thing that we find in verse 2. The enemies here that are building a temple for Yahweh, the God of Israel, they come to Zerubbabel and the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because like you," and out comes all this stuff, which sounds good. And if you're kind of living a life which just, you know, here's the right words and gets duped by that and doesn't see behind them, you would buy that. you might, in the interests of being, you know, open and all the rest of it, you might actually buy what they say in verse 2 there. But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the family, they've got their antennae twitching. They know that these people are enemies. They know that these people have not been worshipping Yahweh. And they know that they've been worshipping lots of other gods. And the whole point of the exile, and the whole point of going back and rebuilding the temple is, you cannot mix the worship of Yahweh with the worship of anybody else. If they have not been worshipping Yahweh exclusively and no other god, then they have no part in building a temple for the one who says, I am the Lord, my glory I will not give to another. You will have no other gods before me. No idols or anything like that. These people riddled with idols in Trans-Euphrates. So the Zerubbabel and his families are not duped by this infiltration strategy. Remember the Israelites, when they were escaping and they in the Exodus and making their way, it was a mixed company. And because it was a mixed company, there was the murmuring starting and the complaining. And there were the people hankering back for the cucumbers of Egypt, which you would in the desert. You know, cucumber salad sounds good. It's this mixed thing. And always the work of God falters when a place is given to those who are living for other gods in the actual driving of the whole thing and the leadership of the whole thing. Now, there is a lot to be said for belonging, believing, begetting, rather than believing, belonging, getting, in terms of life of fellowship, in terms of friendships that we form, in terms of, you know, people being able to, you know, make a contribution in some way or another to the life of the congregation. You know, that you don't make everybody jump through the hoops before they can stack chairs or be welcomed or become anybody's friend or anything like that. But what we're talking about here is right at the very core of things. And the great danger in the infiltration that is resisted is that the worship of God as the one true God will be, almost immediately they've come back, will be become as diluted and compromised as it was before they went into exile. What does that say? It says they've learned a lesson. They've learned the lesson of the exile. So there's infiltration. The second part of the strategy is discouragement. So verse 4, then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. It's discouragement, intimidation thing. We'll come back to. It's just going to take the heart out of the people. And so they hire counselors to work against them. To be alongside them, but working against them. So every opportunity that might present itself will be exploited. So there they are rebuilding. Is it hard work? Oh, well, just give up for a while. You know, did someone get injured shifting those heavy stones? Well, we really ought to stop this. We're not ready for this. We're just not equipped for this. Were there a few days when, you know, it just happened that there were people off sick and well, look, you know, people are obviously losing heart. They're just not in this. We need to just stop and rein back in, reorganize and all that kind of stuff. Just any little chink and they'll be right in there doing their counseling, you know, giving their advice. That means to work against them and frustrate their plans. No, I don't think you should do that yet. I think we need another few months on stone lifting courses before we actually go ahead and do any stone lifting. And then I don't know who's going to do that. So let's just leave the stones there, shall we? You just hear that kind of thing. And you're just against it and against it and against it. It's like water dripping on you. Just wears you down. And then the third part of the strategy they do the power play thing very well. So at the beginning of Xerxes, they lodge an accusation against the people of Jerusalem, Judea. And then they follow that through in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. We get this lot, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of his associates writing a letter. The rest of the associates mean judges and officials over the men from Tripolis, Persia, Erech, Babylon, the Elamites of Susa, verse 9. What are they doing? They're levering the power, the big power. Xerxes, Artaxerxes. Now they're not just levering the big power for themselves, they're levering the big power away from the people of Judah who had Cyrus, who is now dead, that they could appeal to in the past. You know, there was a new pharaoh who did not know the people of Israel. So the guy, the big power, the big cheese, Cyrus, who was for them, he's gone. They immediately start levering in the new big cheeses, Xerxes, Artaxerxes. So it's this power play. We'll just get the levers working against you. And they do it very effectively. And they do it, that power play thing, with innuendo, with inaccuracies, with a rewriting of the history to suit them. They do the power play thing by threatening the king's money, verse 13, go for the jugular. They just, you know, say you're going to be weak if you don't do something about this. Verse 16, we inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are destroyed, you will be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. Now, they get in there first. So they're going to grip the mind. Anything else is an attempt to recover ground. So they get in there and get Artaxerxes' mind on their side. And Artaxerxes can go and he can dig through the records and he does and he finds that, you know, this lot, you know, they once had a big empire. Verse 20, Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates. David. Solomon. Taxes, tribute, and duty were paid from Queen of Sheba, entering musically with all her gifts. You know, you just go back, yeah, it's all there. But it's now being manipulated and used against them. In the power play. And then the fourth part there, which begins with S by mistake, it's this total intimidation that we get the impression of in verse 23. As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, secretary and their associates, you can just imagine, yes, here it is, you're waving a piece of parchment, a scroll, whatever. They went immediately, don't waste a second, to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. Just total intimidation. And it worked. The rebuilding of the wall stopped until Nehemiah came back. And verse 24, the rebuilding of the temple had stopped until the second year of Darius, king of Persia. And we get on into chapters 5 and 6 on that. So what do we learn? Well, we learn something of the nature of the opposition, but we also learn what we've got there in point 3, expect opposition. Expect it. Where, anywhere that God is at work, expect opposition. Expect it on many fronts at once. Expect it to be persistent. Expect it to strike at the fellowship with God. Expect it to have a strategy. And be clever. And be good with words. And smarmy. Expect it. Expect it to have got in under the radar and take you by surprise. Expect opposition anywhere that God is at work. Now, we're not going to take time to read Ephesians 6, but why is it that Paul writes to the church in Ephesus and talks about warfare and putting on the whole armour of God so that you can stand and keep standing? You have to go and save an entire continent. Just stay upright. That's enough. because anywhere that God is at work, Satan will be in with the opposition. Why? Because he can't stand God and hates God being glorified in ways that, you know, would never make it into Scripture, we would think. Ways that might seem eensy-weensy to the rest of the world, or in ways that are huge. Expect opposition anywhere that God is at work. So Paul writes to people in the church in Colossae and says, be alert, be on your guard. Stay awake and watchful. And it's a picture of guys on the wall looking out, constantly vigilant, expecting that somebody will attack. Be alert, be wakeful for what's coming over the horizon. In the same way that if you know exams are coming over the horizon, you stay awake and revise. In the same way that if you know your wedding is coming over the horizon, you stay awake and do the stationery. What's coming, what you expect, governs the way you are now. Be alert, stay awake, be watchful. So, with these things in mind, there's some questions. And I hope that you benefit from learning them, and that we as a fellowship benefit as well. And you'll see that there may be other aspects of the opposition that you've noticed, and please do talk about those, share them, and then we'll look at Gilk and our own individual lives as well.